Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Pelle Lindqvist. Pelle is a Swedish obstetrician and epidemiologist with particular interest in the role of sun exposure habits in health outcomes. He has become more well known, particularly because of his publications in the last decade on how sun exposure impacts disease incidence and mortality. In 2014 and 2016, Pelle and his colleagues used data from the Melanoma in Southern Sweden cohort of 30,000 women over 20 years. The published results demonstrated that those with the greatest sun-seeking habits had the lowest all-cause mortality when compared to those with the lowest sun-seeking habits. These results have since been replicated using data from the UK Biobank, making it crystal clear that our disconnection from sunlight is affecting health in a foundational manner. It was such an honor to get the chance to meet and speak with Pelle at his home. His work has been and will continue to be extremely influential in changing current sun exposure guidelines to be more nuanced and much less dogmatic. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share my deep dives into topics like this. It's the best way to support me and the podcast while also getting more in-depth thoughts about these podcast topics. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Pelle, thank you so much for inviting me to your home to have a discussion with you about your work. This is a real privilege and honor to get to speak with you.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked.
So, your work has become quite popular in the groups that I'm surrounded with, mainly because of the two papers that you published from the Melanoma in Southern Sweden cohort data.
Yeah,
And I believe that. Was originally set up to look at the increasing incidence of melanoma that was happening in Sweden at the time to see what might be contributing. And I think it was more or less set up because it was anticipated that more sun exposure would lead to more melanoma. Is that sort of the way?
Yeah, that's correct. And the other people in the research group are actually doing research on those with the greatest amount of sun exposure in order to identify those with the highest risk. I'm looking at the other side. I'm looking at those with the lowest sun exposure to identify the positive health effects of sun exposure.
So this isn't your original background, though, looking into the effects of sunlight on health outcomes.
Yeah, no, it isn't. I was actually doing genetic research in association with pregnancy. I'm an obstetrician, and I was doing it on factor 5 laden and. We had a large prospective cohort of 2,400, and 270 women were carriers, and after the study, people told me that women. No, I have destroyed their lives. These 270 will have angst and be depressed for the rest of their life because of the knowledge of a dangerous mutation. However, this was not our view of the thing. Women seemed quite satisfied. So in the end, we asked them. We sent an inquiry and asked how they thought about their knowledge. And 96% were glad that when they were curious that they got the knowledge, and 85% changed their method of preventive. But the most interesting question was a question that was never asked. We ended the inquiry with the question: "Is there anything else you want to tell us?" And many women wrote with a little different texting, but they wrote that after the knowledge of carriership, I'm starting to eat better, train more, to live a more healthy life. They got a knowledge of a mutation that would increase the risk of thrombosis, and they took actions to lower the risk. And in my way of seeing it, the women are rational, and if they know one thing, they try to compensate for it. So here, women want to know the ways to reduce their risk of thrombosis. I'm a thrombosis doctor in Sweden. That's my primary aim. Yeah. I'm responsible for the thrombosis risk estimations among pregnant women in Sweden, and so. And actually, I was hunting with a colleague, and he had this. He was responsible for the miss cohort, and I thought it was very, very well. It was taken from the population registry. 40,000 women were asked, 30,000 were answering the inquiry and went into the study. And they were following up every 10th year, and they have all the data to adjust for. So my hypothesis at the time, which later I know that it's wrong, but it was women with vitamin D deficiency are. Have an inflammatory tendency. All inflammatory tendencies are increasing the risk of thrombosis. And so my thought was that if you those with increasing sun exposure would be less inflammatory. And I asked and he was laughing, but finally I got to do my thing, and so the first study was on risk of thrombosis depending on how you're sun exposed, and let me see, for all different. And we choose four questions, and for each yes, the more they sun exposed, the least thromboembolism they got during the oncoming 11 years.
So that's sort of a bit of serendipity, how you became involved with this cohort.
Yeah.
Is it easy to, you know, get access to the data from these large cohorts and you know, do a study like this?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a personal friend, so that makes it easier.
It makes it easier, but it is possible even if you weren't.
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
I wouldn't think so, but I don't know.
Mm. And I mean, when you published, I think the first analysis was 2014.
Yeah.
From the melanoma in southern Sweden cohort about all cause mortality.
Yeah.
What was the original desire? Like, what did you want to get from that original analysis?
Okay. We are jumping one thing. While we were doing this with the thromboembolism, I was seeing that type 2 diabetes was very similar.
Yeah.
They are inflammatory. They have problems with increased blood pressure and most of the type 2 diabetics have low vitamin D levels. So we did the same thing, and for each yes on the same questions, there was 30-40% higher risk of getting type 2 diabetes during the oncoming 11 years.
Right.
And the thing, now we are up to the date when you are asking, we had two of our major causes of death were dependent on sun exposure.
Yeah.
Is all cause death? Does it differ too? And then we had a 20-year follow-up, and so the hypothesis was: do you die more often from if you don't sun expose? Oh, yes, you die more often,
mm-hmm.
but you have a little higher incidence, some 30% higher incidence of melanoma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing Prue noted to me when we spoke is that the cancer incidence was higher in those who were more sun exposed. And I think you make that point where it's the reduction of all-cause mortality is predominantly in cardiovascular and non-cancer.
Now you're up to the next paper. This is a 2016 paper.
Yeah, yeah.
And after this, the next quick question, when you can see that the women had a doubled risk of dying in the forthcoming 20 years, mm-hmm. what do they die from?
Mm-hmm.
And then we can see that women, there was a half risk of dying of cardiovascular disease,
mm-hmm.
mainly myocardial infarction and stroke. Thromboembolism is in that category. It was a one-third risk of dying in other diseases,
mm-hmm.
and that is autoimmunity, diabetes, rheumatism, MS. And there was actually a 40% lower risk of dying in cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a 40% lower risk of dying in cancer among those. But here comes a thing that is mixing everything up. Other diseases is reduced by a factor of 3. Cardiovascular diseases is reduced by a factor of 2. Cancer death is reduced by 40%. What will happen with the prevalence of cancer?
Mm.
More people will die of cancer. Because if they live three years longer, they get more time to get their cancer diagnosed and have it as a cause of death.
Yeah, well, that was the point that Prue made to me. She said, well, of course, the people who are living longer are dying more of cancer because they're just living longer, and the number one risk factor of cancer is age.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes sense, but I think some people have used that. Well, they get more,
But the risk of cancer is lower.
Yes.
But the prevalence of cancer is, and this is many people can't differ between these two, and this has been, if you just make a count on how many that's dying. In Sweden, for example, the incidence of melanoma is increasing 5% per year,
mm-hmm.
but the risk of dying in melanoma is about 2% lower for each year.
Yeah,
and this was before the new cancer agents were presented.
Mm-hmm.
And
so I mean, this is something that gets lost in the fray a little bit, I think, because by the time you make it to 70 or 80, you've got cancer of some description. It's just, is that cancerous growth going to kill you?
Yeah.
Or is it just going to be there when you die of something else? And, you know, with more modern diagnostic techniques, I know this is something that Richard Weller has mentioned, that the diagnosis of melanoma is something that's a little bit controversial at the moment.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And, you know, that sort of plays into the, you know, difficulties with understanding the dynamics of the disease and when, you know, where people are really at risk. And it seems to me as though the people who are really at risk are those that have, you know, very little sun exposure, and then they might go for a holiday and be, you know, have that sort of intermittent exposure.
Yeah, binge sunning.
Yeah.
So you can binge the drink or you can binge sun.
Yeah. And particularly for people of Swedish descent with, you know, lighter skin tone, the effects are going to be more pronounced.
Yeah,
and this is something that is, you know, something that needs to be taken into account is how transferable do you think the data is from the Southern Sweden cohort to elsewhere in the world where people, there are different populations with different skin types and different, you know, different amounts of UV light present. You know, I mean, personally, I think the underlying message is the same, that we've disconnected from being outside in the sun, whether it contains UVB or not, and being outside is going to be net beneficial. But how transferable do you think the results from the melanoma in Southern Sweden cohort is elsewhere?
I think I think that it's a very, the results can be generalized to Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's the same already done at the Mediterranean. It might differ. People are here in Sweden, we hardly have any sun at all.
Mm.
So, do you know how many days of strong sun Sweden have with the UV index?
I know UVB is available for 186 days of the year.
Yeah, but how many days a year do you think that we have UV index higher than six?
I think
six and higher.
Is it under 10 days a year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know how many it is in northern Australia?
Yes. Every day of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. It, even if it's raining the whole day, you have a UV index.
Yeah.
So it is entirely different.
Mm.
Different. The different milieu but in the same time, in many of the Southeast Asian and also in Australia, people are vitamin D deficient.
Mm.
And this is I would say the vitamin D deficiency, for me, it is mainly a lack of sun exposure.
Mm, absolutely. And I notice here there's a very strong emphasis on vitamin D supplementation for obvious reasons. But I get the sense that people think...
Wait a minute. Where is it?
In Sweden, in general, the milk is fortified, which is new to me. We don't fortify.
Oh, okay, this is very, very new. In Sweden, Sweden has had a little supplement fortification in the milk before,
mm-hmm.
but since 2018, we copied. Sweden copied the Finnish guidelines, and the Finnish guidelines, both Sweden and Finland, we have around in the populations, around 50% vitamin D deficiency. Mm-hmm. And in, you want to hear?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
In 2003, Finland thought that and this is if you define vitamin D deficiency as less than 50 nanomole per liter, that's the usual definition. They were determined to lower the Nordic guidelines, says that we are supposed to, the goal is that 97.5% should be sufficient. But in 2003, they started a fortification with everything that you could drink to the meal, and all everything that you can put on your bread. And in 2009, they assessed the results, and it was too little. Mm. And then in Finland, they doubled the dose in 2010, and they recommended all inhabitants in Finland to take 1,000 units extra vitamin D per day. And in Sweden, we copied the Finnish fortification, but without the extra vitamin D supplementation. And the thing is, in Sweden, in most countries, we have had 50 nanomole per liter as a level of sufficiency. In Sweden, they lowered the level so that a recent amount of Swedes should be vitamin D sufficient. Mm. So we have had at times 25 and at times 30 nanomole. So Swedes needs less vitamin D.
Well, I know the Endocrine Society puts that cutoff for deficiency at 75.
Yeah, no, I know, but in our study, mm. we had when we are measuring, we are hardly ever see any Swedish pregnant women that having 75 or more.
Yeah, right.
So by that definition, all our women are deficient.
Are there studies that have looked at the native Sami people to track their vitamin D levels, just as a comparison to see, what it would have been like? I suspect the maybe increased consumption of things like fatty fish and organ meats may have contributed significantly.
I haven't seen it.
Mm. It would be interesting to know what the natural level should be.
Yeah.
But I guess the something that's come to me is that I think a lot of people think taking a vitamin D supplement sort of allows them to never go outside in the sun.
But when you're telling among our pregnant women or FAS or the pharmaceutical specialties, they recommend against using any supplements, right, including vitamin D. They advised our pregnant women against the use. So they actively, I don't know. But in FAS you can read that they don't.
That's very interesting. I would have thought it would have been the opposite.
We have just assessed the risk of intrauterine death, stillbirth, and in Finland, for each step, they are increasing the fortification. They were 4.1 per thousand before 2003, and then it was 3.4 per thousand. And then it, after 2010, it is 2.8 per thousand, lowest in the world.
It's huge, isn't it? For a relatively small intervention.
Very small. And in Sweden, the level was around 4 until 2018, and it decreased to 3.2. Mm-hmm. And a major thing here in Sweden is our immigrant population. Mm-hmm. The fortification is still heavily dependent on milk product, and what you put on your bread, but our immigrant population don't drink milk. And the Indian women they are taking the bread in their food. They are not using butter on it. So and now we can see that the last couple of years the differences in risk of stillbirth is increasing between Swedish born. So the Southeast Asians have doubled risk, and the African women have five times the risk now. So it is increasing.
Well, this is something that William B. Grant has spoken about as well in America, that the people who have the darkest skin, there's a notable health disparity there. And he's done, I think, ecological studies, suggesting that at least a good portion of that disparity can be explained by the extra requirement they have for high energy, sunlight, to basically run their vitamin D synthesis and all of the other things that high energy photons are doing. But one thing that stands out about Scandinavia is it's sort of the type 1 diabetes capital of the world. And I know Michael Hollick has presented data. There was a scare, I think it was in the 90s, that vitamin D fortification could have been dangerous. People worried about, there were titration issues with some of the milk and some people got sick and it got really overblown and Finland started to cut down on the amount of fortification.
Yeah, they did.
And when they did that, it was a complete stepwise increase in type 1 diabetes incidence. Every time they lowered the fortification, type 1 diabetes went up, the exact opposite. And, clearly there's a relationship. I know you, in one of the book chapters you contributed to, you note that there... I think there's something like an 80% decreased risk of type 1 diabetes for people who supplemented adequately.
During the first year of life.
During the first year.
So then there was 80% of those that supplemented were 80% lower risk of type 1 diabetes during early and late adolescence.
And this is a disease that's lifelong and requires quite a bit of and I think the government subsidizes the monitors, the patches here, to the continuous glucose monitors.
So this is
if you can lower it with something as simple as going outside into the sun during the summer, it seems like a pretty an intervention that policymakers should be quite interested in. Yet, here we are, you saying that the recommendations for expecting mothers is to reduce the amount of vitamin D supplementation.
I think that do you know what vitamin D is made of from?
I know it's made from cholesterol the membrane.
So when you are sun exposing, you are lowering your LDL cholesterol and you're actually improving your HDL cholesterol. So one thing that we have been thinking about is everybody knows that high cholesterol is a marker for high cardiovascular disease. It might be a marker of low sun exposure.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I really think that the data is very clear on sun exposure and cardiovascular disease risk. I know Richard Weller's group did the UK Biobank study, essentially yeah. replicating what you had shown yeah. years before with even more people.
And it was, they had 360,000.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but they have only solarium use.
Right. Which I to be perfectly honest, I think is going to provide less benefits than sunlight anyway. Because, you know, when you're using a solarium, you're only getting 312 nanometer light, you know, for a specific purpose where sunlight has, you know, the broad spectrum that's going to present even more beneficial effects. So it's...
Yeah, but we see even in our study, women that are using solarium are... They have a higher risk of melanoma, but they live longer.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, it's a kind of. I don't really know. The studies that has been done are not washed for. If you are in a solarium, you know exactly how long time you're there. And in terms of medical solarium, data from South Korea, those that have been more than 100 times due to vitiligo, they are living longer. And medical solarium has never been associated with melanoma. So I think that it's two different groups, one that is prone to overexpose and one that is not. And it is the overexposure that you have to... personal, I think that in Sweden, many people should benefit from going to the solarium a couple of times during winter.
That's really interesting. I know that there's debate about the whole solarium issue, primarily because I think when they first came out, they were using UVA, which does have beneficial effects with regard to, you know, liberating nitric oxide in the skin and so forth. But I'm aware...
But in Sweden still, it is very, very UVA... high in UVA, it's not natural light.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, do you think that might be causing other issues? I mean, I know when you look at the net outcome, the people who are using solariums tend to live longer, but do you think that the sort of unnatural use of this light, particularly during winter when I suppose, you know, the body...
I do think that you should avoid to be vitamin D deficient. Mm. Do you in Sweden here? It is during the winter. If you live normally during the summer, you get enough.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have a Swedish temperament and go out when it is sun out, our first generation immigrants don't have that custom.
Mm.
So they are probably more, they haven't learned the Swedish way.
This is something I spoke to Nina Jablonski about quite a bit. You know, with increasing amounts of, you know, migration, particularly of people with darker skin to places with less sunlight intensity, how do you start to have the discussion about sun exposure being different for people with darker skin? It seems like a pretty touchy subject, one that, you know, the politics of it might get in the way of actually getting the right information to the right people. I mean...
Yeah, it is a problem. I was having a male conversation with a colleague in the States, and he later found out that he was black. And he told me that all his friends, they were dying early in myocardial infarction and stroke, and in his family, people were dying early in myocardial infarction and stroke, and I know that black people in the States, they have a 30% over mortality, and scientists are looking for socioeconomical effects of that, and he was doing his own calculations, and he assessed the risk of getting melanoma and the risk of getting myocardial infarction or stroke, and in his calculation he had 5,000 higher risk of getting a myocardial infarction and stroke. And so he started to use solarium three times a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to be more black, but to get the health.
Yeah, to meet the needs that his skin type requires.
Yeah. And I think that in Australia, with the new guidelines, the new statements, they are separating whiteies from those with more and they have more relevant guidelines today. In Sweden, we are not there yet.
It's astonishing that it's taken this long to recognize that clearly we need different recommendations for people of different skin tones.
I mean, that seems
quite obvious to me, and I'm not an expert.
It is. And actually, the Western guidelines is a problem for countries in Southeast Asia. They are reading the guidelines here, and they are trying to be the same down there. I had an Indian colleague, and she told me 15 years ago, all women were in the afternoons, they were sitting drinking their tea on the roof of the house. Now they didn't want to expose to the sun because it was dangerous. Now they were sitting down inside in the dark, and they were following our recommendations. Mm-hmm. And this is probably the reason that they have so much deficiency down there.
Mm. And diabetes as well.
Yeah.
One thing that's clear, or at least it seems clear to me about melanoma, is this intermittent exposure, the binge sunlight.
Yeah.
And I was reading in the chapter that you contributed to on vitamin D, you write, in 2011, 30% lower rate of all-cause mortality was reported among those who took a sunbathing vacation at least once a year over the course of 3 decades.
That was not
your work, but it was something that was cited in something. To me, that seems to constitute an intermittent exposure.
Yeah.
When you go, you know, perhaps during winter, you know, you go to Italy and you
But
even then, even with that exposure dynamic of the binge sunlight, there was still a lower all-cause mortality.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It seems like the trade-off really is...
Yeah. Okay. In that publication, they also showed that those burning... We're living longer, so we have the same results, but we are not publishing it because we don't think that people should burn.
Mm.
But they reported that it was better. They didn't write it, yeah. but to follow their results. It's better to burn and be out than not being in the sun. We did have the same results, but we didn't want people to to overexpose.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's probably a
So we didn't put it down on paper.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know sunburn, particularly during childhood, is quite a poignant risk factor for melanoma later in life. So it's, I mean, it's
and non-exposure to sun during childhood is a heavy risk factor for autoimmunity.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's what we improve is scared about. It is that the youngsters are not out now and they are getting MS later.
Well, something that Prue made very clear to me was that this latitude gradient we see for MS is almost non-existent at the equator, and then the further away you get, the more MS you see. And I think now the studies, there have been enough studies to show that this is a vitamin D independent process, that this is happening. Something else is going on with UV light when it's touching the skin, but it's not vitamin D. It might involve vitamin D, but it's not. I mean, if you supplement vitamin D, it doesn't make any difference. So do you think that the sort of monopoly that vitamin D research has on the interactions between life and UV light, do you think that's sort of holding us back from discovering, potentially other things that are going on with UV light? I know she's spoken about urokinic acid, which seems to be a very interesting product that's made from histidine in the skin. Who knows how many different things are made on the skin? And if we just focus on vitamin D, we might be missing out on a lot of those that could help explain other things that we notice with sunlight exposure.
It is an interesting question you have. The main problem here is that only risk factors for UV exposure are founded. So a lot more than 95% of all research are done on risk of the bad conditions due to sun exposure. Of course, this is very interesting to go through. Everything mandates back to, I think it's 81, when it was an Australian that was questioning the temperature hypothesis, and thought it must be something with UV exposure, supposedly vitamin D, and this was the start of a huge amount of vitamin D. Actually, on this 30, 40 years, we have not. We have not increased our knowledge the way we should have done. We should have had a more scientific sound approach to the whole thing.
I mean, this comes back to the issues with science in general and how funding is dealt out. This is something that Andre has, struggled with and Michael Hollick, they stopped getting funding that, they had got previously. It seems like a tricky subject. I know in Australia it would be so remarkably difficult to turn around and say, actually, you do need to get some amount of sunlight because it's protective of
But Australia is the most liberal country with their recommendations. The recommendations in Sweden is a lot stricter, and we hardly have any sun.
Well, that's interesting to hear.
And we have a melanoma incidence that are almost as high as in Australia,
which is stunning to think that.
No, it isn't. We have amazingly bad recommendations.
Mm.
The recommendation in Sweden, they didn't dare to say that you should be avoiding too much sun. Mm. They didn't dare to say that. So they said, as long as you cream yourself, it's okay. Yeah. And this is a problem in Sweden. That's my own conclusion.
Yeah.
Those that cream themselves are a doubled risk of melanoma in Sweden.
Really?
Yeah. And the absolutely highest risk are those that cream themselves to be out for long in the sun.
Yes, exactly.
They have 10 times higher risk of melanoma. Yeah. My explanation is that you are focusing on burning.
Yeah.
The cream is made not to let the skin burn, but it don't lower the risk of melanoma.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't burn, but you get overexposure.
Yeah.
And actually, I've been trying here in Sweden to switch to avoid overexposure instead of avoid burning. In Australia, I can see in the new statements they are taking in that part. They are more and more focusing on avoiding overexposure because it seems that they understand that you need sun exposure, but you should not. You should do it in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, the reddening of the skin, the erythema, is the message from nature saying time to go in the shade. And when you lose that, it's not only, my understanding is that it's not only the UV light. When you use sunscreen, you're able to expose yourself to high energy visible light as well for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
And the violet and blue wavelengths penetrate even deeper to the basal layer. Which might explain why it's more common to get basal cell carcinoma when you use sunscreen, because you're able to stay out for so much longer than you should.
Yeah, and that's one of the main things. Actually, the guidelines in Sweden has been changed from the Strålskyddsmyndigheten. But they have not communicated this to the general population. The switch before it was the last between 40 and 10 years ago. It was as long as you cream yourself, it's good.
Yeah.
But now sun cream is not present, so you should go to the shade or you should dress which are correct, but still, since they haven't communicated, the people are still thinking as long as you cream yourself, it's good.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I don't know if you have looked into this very much, but there's a lot more in the total solar spectrum than UV, and something we miss out on when we come indoors is all the long wavelengths.
The red and near red.
Yeah, mainly. The near infrared and infrared portions. I mean, there's increasing amount of evidence suggesting that these wavelengths play very important roles in mitochondrial bioenergetics. And I know Glenn Jeffrey's group has shown that you can use red light therapy to significantly lower blood glucose spikes. What do you think the implications of this are? The fact that we mostly live indoors, I think Americans spend over 90% of their time indoors. We're completely detached from the long wavelength light that we'd be getting living a natural life. How much do you think this part of the story is playing in the all-cause mortality story?
Honestly, this is outside of my area of expertise, but I do think it's interesting, but I'm I don't have sufficient knowledge to. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you guys use a lot more incandescent lights here than we have in
Australia. What do you mean?
So, you know, the tungsten filament. I mean, that's not a filament. But, you know, the old-style Edison bulbs that produce lots of heat.
Yeah.
So when we used to use those, we were getting lots of infrared light from those. But we've switched to LED.
Yeah.
And those have none whatsoever. It looks exactly the same to our eye, but it's completely... robbing us of the long wavelengths. And it's interesting to think how much of an impact that might be having, just sort of detaching because, you know, people who... it's my understanding that people who spend most of their time indoors, these are the people who are at most risk of melanoma.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, if that is the case, perhaps, you know, getting... narrowband emission of visible light without the long wavelengths is a potential contributor to cancers of the skin. You know, maybe not melanoma, maybe melanoma, I'm not sure. I mean, it's clear you've heard of the interaction between red light and the cells.
I've heard it. I don't know the area sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been reading it into the way I should too.
It's probably not something that's going to get you a lot of grant money either.
No.
So, what are you working on now?
I've been following up some Australian studies.
Mm-hmm.
This is Shelley Gorman's group. They have shown that they have done some excellent mice studies,
mm-hmm.
on glucose metabolism, where they have shown that they have a more advanced setting, but if you make it easy, then you have mice when you are UV exposure, and you have mice without UV exposure, and those and you feed them with high fat diet, and those with UV exposure go up less in weight. They have better glucose tolerance, lower insulin resistance, lower cholesterol, and less hepatic steatosis. If you block nitric oxide, the effects don't happen, and you cannot get these effects by vitamin D.
Mm.
So this indicates that the effect of UV exposure is from nitric oxide on type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
And they made studies on overweight mice, and they get the same result: improved glucose tolerance, less insulin resistance, less liver steatosis, and those that were exposed to UV exposure, they dropped in weight. So that was. So here we have animal studies. We have the source, the mechanism, and I'm as an epidemiologist. Is there a biological gradient? And so we have just is an accepted paper where we see that the more we have a strong dose-dependent inverse association between sun exposure and incident type 2 diabetes.
That's so fascinating. I mean, it's such a huge problem,
yeah,
the type 2 diabetes problem.
And we can see that the effect from sun exposure is similar to that of exercise.
Mm.
So exercise and sun exposure show about the same effects on lowering the risk. And the main risk factor, if you're going to stay without getting type 2 diabetes, the main thing is to remain normal weight.
Mm.
But in the same time, I do think that sun exposure will have these studies are not done yet. But I would be surprised if those sun exposing try to reduce their weight if it isn't helpful.
Would it be ethical to run an RCT by exposing people to sunlight, you know, getting a group of people and putting them out in the sun? I know that's a bit of an ethical issue.
Yeah, I don't think that it would be acceptable in Sweden.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, because then, you know, you're not guessing about certain what wavelengths
are
doing.
No, but the first thing, you can't get funded. Funny, yeah. So it's no idea to even start to. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can get funded in Sweden.
Yeah. In 2020, you published a paper. It's sort of a who's who of everyone in this group. I know Prue was involved, Cedric Garland, Bruce Armstrong. You wrote, insufficient sun exposure has become a real public health problem.
Yes.
What prompted that paper?
Yeah, we did have a joint meeting in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first of two meetings. We have another meeting now in the spring here, mm-hmm. also in Washington.
All right. And you obviously felt that this was important enough to put your heads together and write a paper that would hopefully reach...
Yeah, it is interesting that there's a lot of people, both... in the first meeting, there were a lot of people both for and against sun exposure. I thought it was quite interesting.
Mm.
But I think the second meeting here was better.
Okay. Yeah. Will you publish another paper with that group of people?
Yeah. I was just thinking here what happened with them, we were determined to publish a paper, mm-hmm. in common, but we are not there yet.
Difficult to organize everyone.
No, I don't really know what's the problem.
Mm.
It was some very interesting we had but one of the things that I thought was most interesting that there was behavioral differences. Mm. Depending on by what's her name, Levy. Carmen Levy.
Mm. That goes back a long time. I know prison programs that got the inmates to garden saw dramatic improvements just getting them outside gardening in the amount of antisocial behavior that was going on. This has been shown many times. And I know that there has been a paper, I think it was 2019 or something, that was suggesting that, I don't think they said this explicitly, but people with darker skin had greater tendencies toward addictive behaviours because the amount of UV light needed to activate, the release of beta endorphin was much higher, and if you weren't reaching that, you tended towards more addictive behaviors, because this endorphin system is supposed to be run essentially by UV light, and if you're not getting enough, it causes a bit of a disturbance in that regulatory system.
I've been thinking in just the opposite way.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
I've done the redhead study, and redheads, they are drinking more, they are smoking more. And people say that they need more anesthetic during surgery. I've been thinking just the opposite.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I wonder why that would be. Do you have any initial ideas about why people with red hair might be?
I think that the people with red hair have red hair because. It is a survival advantage. Mm. If you live up here and have red hair, you live. I mean, we have shown that.
Yeah.
They have an 8% longer life expectancy.
Wow.
And the price of this is that they have 59% higher risk of dying of skin cancer.
Yeah.
But this the only thing that's communicated is the higher risk of skin cancer.
Yeah.
But that's the price for the longer life.
Mm. We've been talking about UV light, which is essentially invisible electromagnetic energy. On the other side of the spectrum, we start to get into radio waves and microwaves and the communications technologies. I don't know if you know Olli Johansson at Karolinska. He published, I think it was 2014 or something, looking at the introduction of FM broadcasting in Sweden and the incidence and mortality of melanoma, and found some interesting relationships between the onset of FM broadcasting and the changing nature of melanoma in Sweden. And this also seems to have happened in Australia as well. There's a paper essentially saying the exact same thing. You know, given that we're essentially now bathed in electromagnetic energy that's not native, it's not normal to have on the earth, how much of a role do you think this might be playing, not only in melanoma, but in human health in general?
I don't know. I know that they have been doing research regarding mobile phones with brain tumors, the scientific proof. I don't know, and it's not my area either. But it might be something there, of course. So far I haven't seen any. The problem with my research and the problem with this kind of research, with the diabetes here, with the Sally Gorman's group doing the animal experiments. If I'm starting from a little different angle, with type 2 diabetes, we are almost at a level now that if the present studies might be replicated, we are at a causal relationship. And the problem with my I'm publishing observational data and strong observational data, and with the dose response. So it's a large, well done cohort, but we still need in order to getting closer to causal relationship, we need both mechanism and we need animal studies. Mm. It's the same thing with this radio waves. You have to have. I'm hoping that the preclinical groups would grab my research and do the so it's a kind of jumping back and forth between epidemiological, mechanistic, and animal research to get ahead towards a causal relationship.
What do you hope for your work and your contributions? What do you hope to be sort of remembered for, and what do you hope to contribute in general?
I would be very glee. I do think that avoidance of sun exposure is our fourth major lifestyle factor affecting our health negatively, together with smoking, inactivity, and overweight. Yeah. So it seems to be in the same size, and I'm quite sure that in time it will be shown. I know that it isn't possible to get funding for me or for the other groups. Yeah. You can't get it falls back to the funding.
Yeah.
By not giving funding, we are not getting closer to better health.
Mm. How do you think we'll overcome this funding issue, or is it just going to inevitably be a very, very slow journey towards understanding what I think you already know?
Yeah, I think I think you mentioned the big UK Biobank study. Mm. I think that's a major contributor, yeah. And I think that they have replicated ours. And what we need here is the day when Shelley Gorman's studies are replicated. They have to be replicated by another group.
Yeah.
In order to get accepted, and I hope to that this could be done in hearing at KNKI.
Mm. I sincerely hope that we can continue moving in this direction. And I think you've been quite a major player in bringing this information to light and getting people to understand how important being outside and getting sunlight on your body is. So, like I said before, you're in our small group back in Australia, you're a bit of a legend. So it's such an honour to get to speak with you and pick your brains. And I've learned a lot. So thank you for giving me some of your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. I've left some links to Pelle's publications in the show notes if you'd like to check out, particularly those two papers from 2014 and 2016 using the melanoma in southern Sweden cohort data. Please feel free to subscribe to the podcast, as it really helped me grow the channel and get more incredible guests to speak with. I also have a Substack that I use to go even deeper into these podcast topics and offer my thoughts and ideas. This is the best way to learn even more while supporting the podcast at the same time. I've left links below where you can follow me on social media, where I share lots of health-related information. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.